protesters out on the streets in northern Pakistan, angry, upset, frustrated at what they say was vote rigging.
From the University of Virginia's Karsh Institute, this is Democracy in Danger. I'm Siva Vaidyanathan. Will Hitchcock is away this week.
In other parts of the country, post-election violence has killed six people and injured dozens.
There is injustice against us. I am inviting all the supporters, as this is a fight for freedom and they have stolen your rights.
Voters in Pakistan went to the polls on February 8th and they delivered a stunning rebuke to their country's political establishment, especially to the military, which tends to pull the strings behind the scenes of Pakistani politics.
Independent candidates backed by Pakistan's jailed ex-leader Imran Khan delivered a surprise victory.
Now, independent candidates affiliated with the populist PTI party and their jailed leader won more seats in the National Assembly than any other bloc of parties. And yet, a weak coalition backed by the generals will still take power in Pakistan. Now, this is all happening amid convincing evidence of vote tampering.
One former government minister showed Al Jazeera evidence from polling stations of the number of votes he received, which differed from the official result. He says he is taking his complaint to court.
In the Punjab province, a senior government official confessed in a press conference to wiping out margins as high as 70,000 votes for 13 independent candidates.
People voted with their hearts, let me tell you this. And what happened with PTI and the independents is totally unjust.
Protesters have been in the streets all over the country. In dozens of locales, PTI leaders are challenging the results in court. Now, with a population of 240 million people, Pakistan is the world's fifth largest country, and it's the second largest Muslim nation. Now, partitioned from India in 1947 after independence from Britain, Pakistan has always had, let's say, an uneasy relationship with democracy. Over the decades, it has seen a dizzying array of coups, de facto military rule, and puppet governments. But there are signs that that may be changing. Increasingly, citizens are expressing their frustrations out in the open and at the polls. Now, here to talk about all of this is Arsalan Khan. He's an anthropologist based at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and he's an expert in Pakistani politics. Now, he's currently living in the coastal city of Karachi, the most populous metropolitan area in Pakistan. Arsalan, welcome to Democracy in Danger.
Thank you for having me, Siva. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. So, first of all, tell us what the mood has been like there since the elections took place about a month and a half ago. What are you seeing going on the ground, in the street? What are people saying and doing?
I think the mood is one of overall anger with the political establishment, the military establishment, and, well, especially a deep resignation, I think, that people have, because inflation here is rampant and working classes are, of course, struggling. But young, educated, middle-class people are also struggling in this economy. And there's a real strong sense of injustice that the political mandate of the electorate was sort of stolen. On the other hand, the political situation is fragile enough and the risks of protest severe enough that few want to take on the military establishment directly on the street, for instance. And it, of course, varies from city to city. Karachi is operating more or less as it does. You do get sort of the sense that of that injustice when you speak to people, but otherwise things are fairly orderly. In Lahore, my understanding is that where Imran Khan is even more popular, I think there's even more anger and more protests. But I do also think that the level of persecution faced by the PTI has really, really created broader support for him. Specifically, I think that people were very offended by and disturbed by the extent to which PTI members were abducted and imprisoned. And then the court case, one of the court cases that was filed against him was over the legitimacy of his marriage, which then went into lurid details about his marriage and whether it was a legitimate marriage or not, into space that I think not just his supporters, who had long said that his personal life was private and not a matter of politics, but many others also believe that they had reached well beyond the kind of ethical boundaries. And I think that created a very big backlash against the establishment that was then expressed in the election.
Well, let's talk about Imran Khan and his popularity, his potential to represent what could be pretty historical changes. And let's not be too glossy about it, right? Khan is a celebrity. He's a former cricket star with, you know, movie star looks. He's world famous, not just famous within Pakistan. And he had been prime minister. He was ousted in 2022 after he fell out of favor with the military. That's how leaders often find themselves out of a job in Pakistan, or sometimes worse. And then Khan has since been imprisoned and accused of revealing state secrets. Now, that led to massive violent riots last May, and Khan is still imprisoned. He's serving a 34-year sentence. And yet, from prison, his influence only seems to grow. He has a campaign that's been using social media and artificial intelligence to send his message out to supporters, to rally support. So what is his secret? How is Khan different from the standard Pakistani politician? And do you see this as something more than a blip or a celebrity phenomenon? Is this a sign of deep enough dissatisfaction that Pakistani citizens are willing to take bigger risks than ever before?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the backstory, as you mentioned, Imran Khan is a cricketing hero in Pakistan. He won the 1992 World Cup for the country. This was considered to be one of the kind of great moments, cricketing moments, certainly, but even historical moments in Pakistan, a really important occasion.
I'm still bitter about that, being a supporter of India in the cricket.
He was also, as you mentioned, always considered one of the most desirable men in Pakistan. He was known for his looks. He was known as a sort of philanderer, as a womanizer, and had basically schmoozed quite a bit with the British aristocracy. He was married to the heiress Jemima Goldsmith. And so he's sort of seen as this figure who had like really put Pakistan on the world map as a celebrity, more so, I think, than almost anybody else. And so he had that kind of popularity going with him. But then in 1994, he started a cancer hospital, Pakistan's only free cancer hospital, Shaukat Khanam Memorial Cancer Hospital. And he sort of networked and recruited funds for this hospital. This is a major achievement that most people recognize as his work as a philanthropist. Mm-hmm. And so he was, not only a cricketer and a celebrity, but also then seen as this moral person who had was committed to Pakistan, despite having his connections to the West and despite having, in a sense, conquered, if you will, the Western elites. He remained committed to Pakistan. I think that was the understanding people had when he launched his political party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, which is the party of justice, in 1996, his rallying cry was basically corruption. The country's primary problem, Khan insisted, was corruption, and the corruption of the elite political classes, and that had been siphoning money. And that was really the key element that has remained consistent in his politics, that he has been a staunch critic of the other major political parties, the Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz, and the Pakistan People's Party.
So it's just a fascinating sort of triangulation of affiliation and affection for the West through his celebrity status, and mm-hmm. yet nationalism and populism domestically, right? It's a pretty powerful formula where he can sort of represent in his stature something quite Western looking, and yet appeal to people who are much more interested in Pakistan for Pakistan, right? In the traditional populist sense. Am I getting that right?
I think that's an excellent way to think about it, actually. And the fact is that he is somebody who managed managed and navigated the West so successfully,
right,
you know, and schmoozed and operated in the upper echelons of society, but still was committed so firmly to Pakistan. That gives him a kind of a sort of idea of his return to Pakistan, a heroic return to Pakistan. You know, this is a country, of course, where many middle class people and upper class people migrate out for better lives. And here's this guy who could have remained in that world, but comes back. This is the narrative, of course, around which Imran Khan's politics crystallize his supporters. Not, of course, many people are quite critical of this story, but this is a powerful narrative that gripped many, many people, particularly young people, around his sort of personal charisma.
Right. So he wins, he serves. And as we know, Pakistan is hard to govern, right? Even with the best of intentions and the highest political skills, Pakistan is hard to govern. It's a huge, diverse country. It has deep endemic problems, many of which are sort of inherited leftover from colonialism. And it has an urge to satisfy a growing population, a very young population, right? So what brought him down ultimately? What was the thing that knocked him off the pedestal in 2022?
So I think it's important to start with the narrative that Khan and his supporters in PTI tell first, right? I mean, the supporters in PTI argument is that this was a U.S. orchestrated coup, essentially. The evidence for this is this document that was sort of labeled secret, that documents a meeting between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. The ouster happened through a vote of no confidence, through a parliamentary procedure in which the parties collectively voted. But it was seen as instigated by the military establishment and then by the United States. Now, lots of critics of this don't agree with it, but this document, this cipher, is a key element in Pakistan's politics, and it was published by The Intercept newspaper, so those who want to read it can read it. And it was seen by Khan's supporters as clear vindication of his narrative, that there was actually foreign intervention. What are the other reasons? Well, you know, many of Khan's critics say this is not the case. In fact, he had an unraveling with the military establishment. You know, it's hard to understand exactly what, because the military is an opaque institution. It's hard to know exactly what causes an unraveling like this. But I think that's one thing I would say is that these kinds of unravelings are not unusual in Pakistan's history. You know, there's this kind of a recurring problem where politicians come to power, they're popular, they have a popular mandate, and when they're in power, they're not really in control of many key decisions. And so they sort of butt heads with the military establishment. And especially in the context of an economic crisis in Pakistan at that time, I think there was like 14 or 15% food inflation. So if you're in power and you got this economic crisis looming, then your power is being eroded, your popularity is being eroded, which is certainly what was happening with Imran Khan. So it's hard to know what was happening internally, but certainly this tension that happens between civilian and military leaders is not uncommon.
Now, clearly, he's an insurgent. He's a populist. He's running against the long-established power center. And like his neighbor, Narendra Modi, he is challenging the deeply embedded elite. The Muslim League, after all, founded Pakistan. Unlike Narendra Modi, he has not been able to consolidate power and rule at his will. So what we're wondering about from the position of people in the United States who are concerned about the viability of democracy around the world, is the Khan movement a pro-democracy movement, even a proto-democratic movement? What is the nature of the support for him? Is it more personal? Is it more indignation against the status quo? Or is there actually a sense, an articulation, that he might represent some sort of establishment of democratic culture and democratic values?
That's a great question. I think that there are lots of question marks that loom around him. I mean, democratic, it certainly is democratic in the sense that it has a popular mandate, and so it has that. Critics would say that the structure of Khan's party is the personal charisma and the sort of cult of personality around which the party revolves really has a more kind of authoritarian element to it. It doesn't have what you see in populists like Modi or Trump, even, where there's an explicit, a direct targeting of specific types of minorities to sort of deflect onto the problems of the country. So that sense that one gets in more authoritarian fascistic movements. I would say that's not really the case with Imran Khan. He doesn't have an other that he is constantly targeting, a minority group of any kind. But the party is structured very much around his personality and around this idea that he's this kind of deeply moral character. And that if you bring in a deeply moral character as the ruler of the country, as the leader of the country, it will wipe out the corruption, wipe out the problems of politics, and kind of usher in what he called a new Pakistan, a naya Pakistan. This was the mantra, right? That he was going to end corruption. He said, I will end corruption in 90 days. Mm. He also said there are $200 billion floating around in Swiss banks or in foreign banks that he's going to bring back. So these are the kinds of fatal claims that he made about how he would personally wipe out corruption. And it does crystallize around this idea that he himself is this trustworthy kind of person.
But you mentioned earlier that he has a almost Western cosmopolitan visage and history. He was known as a philanderer. He married a British woman. He lived the high life in London and elsewhere. How does that track with the demands for piety in what is generally a very conservative Muslim country? How does he navigate that demand? And what does his popularity say about the role of religion in Pakistani life?
Yeah, so Pakistan is a state founded on a sort of Muslim identity where long, almost since its inception, sovereignty has been linked to Islam. Right. In the 1970s and 80s, Pakistan went through an aggressive Islamization campaign under the military dictatorship of General Zia-ul-Haq, Islamized a whole series of reactionary laws against women, many reactionary laws against minorities. So state sovereignty has been kind of strongly tied both legally and politically to Islam. And so claims about Islamic authority are rampant in Pakistani politics. Now, Imran Khan is interesting in that, you're right, he has this sort of background, but he also has a bit of a born-again kind of identity. And so he does marshal Islamic values in the public sphere. In fact, he claimed that his political party was going to bring back the state of Medina, which is the state founded by the Prophet Muhammad, and at the helm of which is this very pious and pure leader. How does that square with his personal life? Well, this is a kind of contradiction. And so people are constantly pointing out this contradiction to his supporters, and they sideline it, or they respond that, people change, or that's his personal life. So there are many ways in which people can justify it. I think the parallel is also, why do so many evangelical Christians support Donald Trump, whose lives seem to have no real reflection of the kinds of family values that evangelical Christians believe in over there? So right. I think it's a similar kind of thing where, he sort of has this identity where piety has become very central to his persona. It's sort of, if you read his autobiography, it's very clear in that autobiography that he sees himself as having come to Islam through his, this sort of long reflection, if you will. So I would say that's important. He's foregrounded Islam and Islamic values, but he doesn't have the baggage that Islamist political parties have, who have mobilized Islam for many years, but have really little to show for it, and who are not seen as capable of really ruling the country. And so he's able to merge the modernist sensibilities of Pakistani middle classes with Islamic values in a very interesting way that I think should be actually explored than has been.
I mean, I think that speaks to that sense of code switching, as he does with his nationalism and his cosmopolitanism, presenting whatever works at the moment. And being all things to all people in that sense, right? And he can also be a legendary philanderer and a deeply pious old man in his 70s, right? So someone who has come to the light, right? That said, he is an old man in his 70s. The world seems to be run by old men in their 70s and maybe even 80s fairly soon. And yet Pakistan is a very young country, like so many countries on the precipice of breaking out and leading economically and culturally and intellectually in the world. Pakistan is youth heavy. Mm. So what are young people in Pakistan thinking about their sense of their place in the world their country's place in the world and the prospects for a different form of government going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Pakistan ranks incredibly low on human development indicators in the world. And Pakistanis and middle-class Pakistanis, educated people are quite aware. And I think that they believe that the promise of the country has been stolen, literally stolen. Many people are really disenchanted. You know, people who can are leaving the country. There's massive brain drain and flight from this country of anybody who has an education, myself included, in a sense. So I think that, you know, I think that lots of people see this and they look around and they look at India or they even look at Bangladesh and they say, you know, what happened? How is it that we are 162 or whatever in the human development list in 190 something countries? And they're really frustrated by that. And that's a frustration that Khan has tapped into. And this idea that we could recover some moral certitude or moral center, then we would be able to transcend these problems that are so clear here. I think that the class of people that Imran Khan's original appeal was were urban middle class people. These are people who work in companies, they work in the private sector, they have educations, they're taxpayers. And so Pakistan has a substantial disproportionate number of taxpayers that are not capitalist or landlords, but instead are professionals. And so I think that these people are frustrated by this, and they see inflation rising. They also were people who were, frankly, historically like pro-army. And so they saw the political leadership of this country as being compromised, not the army being compromised, but the political establishment and the kind of patronage system. So they saw them as backed by feudals or the landed aristocracy that is very much a central presence in many of the political parties, especially the Pakistan People's Party, big businessmen. So, you know, Khan is tapped into, in an odd way, one might say, he's tapped into the army's own narrative. So the army was seen as this kind of well-structured or efficient institution that, unlike other institutions, was governed by merit, not by patronage or not by nepotism. And so I think Khan had tapped into that and turned that into a kind of democratic ethic, if you will, in that sentiment that he couldn't discipline the political system the same way that the army long claimed to be able to discipline the political system.
Arsalan, there have been four elections since the last moment that the military explicitly ruled Pakistan. We would have to go back to the days of General Pervez Musharraf, who, you know, was quite an international figure in the days after the attacks of September 11th, 2001 on the United States and the invasion of Afghanistan and then, you know, that very complicated relationship between the United States and Pakistan in those years. So do you see any prospect of that explicit military rule reviving itself in Pakistan, or is there just too much erosion of trust and faith in the military over that time?
I think that one of the positive developments that we're seeing is that, as I mentioned, the class of people that support Imran Khan often were people who had previously supported military rulers like Pervez Musharraf. And I think that there's now a much deeper sense that military involvement in politics is one of the core sources or contradictions in Pakistan and the conflicts. And I think that that sentiment has grown very large. So it's almost like the military has eroded one of its key constituencies that held it. And so I think there is hope for a growing, broader democratic ethos, which is already the commitment to democracy now. As you mentioned, there have been four elections now. That people have a strong sense now that they can use their democratic vote to challenge all the powers. They can challenge their traditional local, agricultural, rural, landed aristocrats. They can challenge the political parties who have dominated Pakistani politics. They can challenge even the military. And so this sense that democracy has given people is very, very pervasive, even among working class people. Pakistan is also, you know, one of those places where you're seeing very, very widespread availability of internet, telephones, you know, TikTok. People have access to all kinds of knowledge and they're using it to produce all sorts of commentary in a burgeoning kind of public discourse. And so these are the two types of positive developments that we are seeing, out of which I think Imran Khan's politics does come out, regardless of what the critiques of it are. It does show that the Pakistani populace, especially young people, are really eager to demand their political rights. And so the hope is that it will go in that direction. There's a fear that Imran Khan instead will either himself come to dominate in a sort of authoritarian fashion the political system, or will once again ally himself with the military, and then this whole critique of the establishment will then dissipate. Those are two possibilities, and one possibility leads in the direction of democratic ideals.
Well, Arsalan Khan, I hope we can sit down and watch cricket together someday. Thank you so much for joining us on Democracy in Danger.
Thanks for having me, Shiva.
Arsalan Khan is an associate professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's an expert on Islam, ethics, and gender in Pakistan. His first book has just come out. It's called The Promise of Piety, Islam and the Politics of Moral Order in Pakistan. That does it for this episode. Next time, we'll take you to Argentina, where a far-right ideologue known as El Loco has been pushing for economic shock therapy.
Known for wielding a live chainsaw at his campaign rallies, now the libertarian populist is Argentina's new president.
Until then, please stay in touch. Find us on Instagram at DND Podcast. That's D-I-N-D Podcast. And share our posts with your followers. Our webpage is dndanger.org. We've got show notes, great images, links to what we're reading, and much, much more. Democracy in Danger is produced by Robert Armengol, Nicholas Scott, Stephen Betts, and Ariana Aronson. Adin Yeager engineers the show. Our interns are Charlie Burns, Lena Freihat, Katie Pyle, Makhdoum Murad Shah, and Caroline Yu. We have help from Ellie Salvatierra. Support comes from the University of Virginia's College of Arts and Sciences. We're part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. The show is a project of UVA's Karsh Institute of Democracy, and it's distributed by the Virginia Audio Collective of WTJU Radio in Charlottesville. I'm Siva Vaidyanathan. Until next time.